Good evening. After more than a week of threats against FBI agents incited by the former president and his supporters, and after one failed attempt on their lives, our top story tonight is anything but academic. The consequences of it could be very real. Late today, we learned that some of the former president's allies want him to publicly release surveillance camera video of agents searching at Mar-a-Lago last week. Now, remember, he's already suggested on several occasions that they might have planted evidence while they were executing the search warrant. There's no evidence of that at all. And just today, on his social network, he linked to an article describing the FBI as the, quote, fascist bureau of investigation. We'll talk more in a moment about the debate within the former president's circle over putting out this surveillance video or not. But according to reporting in the New York Times by CNN political analyst Maggie Haberman, investigators already have at least some surveillance video from earlier, from before the raid, which may have actually triggered the search. Quoting now, officials then used a subpoena to obtain surveillance footage of the hallway outside a storage room at Mar-a-Lago and saw something that alarmed them. They also received information from at least one witness who indicated that more material might remain at the residence, people familiar with the investigation said. Now, tonight's lead story comes at the end of a day that saw a string of related developments, including Rudy Giuliani going before a grand jury, the outlines of a plea deal involving former Trump Organization Chief Financial Officer Alan Weisselberg, and a declaration of political war from Congresswoman Liz Cheney. We start with the surveillance footage and CNN's Caitlin Collins. So what more do we know about this video that the Trump people are considering releasing?
So we expect that it's several hours of footage, Anderson, because, of course, this raid went on. This search, the raid that the former president has referred to it as, but this search warrant that they executed, they were there for several hours. They got there, we were told, about 9 o'clock in the morning, and they left about 6 p.m. that evening. So it could potentially be several hours worth of surveillance footage that the former president has in his hands, because, as we know, when FBI agents arrived on the scene, they asked to turn the cameras off. We are told that it's pretty standard, not that unusual of an ask by sources inside the Justice Department, but they did make that request, and that is not something that was granted by the officials on the ground at Mar-a-Lago. And so now it is in the hands of the former president and his attorneys, this surveillance footage of what happened at Mar-a-Lago that day. And what we are hearing from sources is that there is basically this internal debate happening over whether or not they should release it, with some people saying that it is not a case of if they release that surveillance footage, but when they release it. But really the debate comes down to two points, which is one, how does it benefit Trump? And some have argued that it could, to show these FBI agents inside the home of a former president taking these boxes. Of course, we know they went inside a storage room where a lot of this material was being held, but Trump has also said they went into his office and into his private quarters at Mar-a-Lago as well. But the other side of the coin, Anderson, is that some people in Trump's orbit don't think it would actually be all that beneficial to show FBI agents in the home of the former president, of course, picking up these boxes that they say had classified information in it that he should have never taken to Mar-a-Lago in the first place. So whether or not it ultimately gets released remains to be seen, but it is certainly a debate happening inside his orbit right now.
They could also, I mean, the people at Mar-a-Lago, they could edit it however they wanted. They could cut out as much footage as they wanted. If they were going to, if they have control of it, they can release whatever they want and keep whatever they want.
Yeah, that's true. And also one concern would be that it would potentially put these FBI agents at risk because it would show and reveal the identities of the agents who were there. That was one concern that we saw officials had after you saw the search warrant that was put out, that was released. It had the names of FBI agents on there. So that's been a concern as well. One other thing, though, I will note is that, you know, when these FBI agents went in to conduct this search, they likely already knew where these cameras were placed because, as you correctly noted at the top of the show, the New York Times and CNN has confirmed that they did subpoena surveillance footage from Mar-a-Lago before this search actually happened. And we were told, obviously, one of those cameras was placed outside the room where these materials were being held. So it's not like they don't know exactly where these cameras were. They had a pretty good idea of it. But whether or not it ultimately comes out remains to be seen. But it does show this debate that's playing out over between the Justice Department and Trump and his attorneys over what should come out, what information should become public. And of course, we know the affidavit that led to that search warrant is the next thing that is potentially being considered before that judge tomorrow.
Yeah, Caitlin Collins, appreciate it. Stay with us. I want to bring in CNN senior law enforcement analyst and former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, also CNN contributor, former Nixon White House counsel John Dean, who has some experience with tapes. Andrew, what do you think the reaction within the FBI would be to the release of these surveillance images?
Deep concern for a number of reasons. First and foremost, when you're executing a search warrant for the purpose of recovering potentially highly classified material, the last thing you want to have is a video of that material released to the public. That's the entire purpose of the warrant, to recover material, get it back into a place that's authorized.
So the FBI, storage. You're saying, would actually be concerned about what is what the camera might pick up on
exactly,
any material.
Exactly. And then, of course, second, and a very close second, I might add, is the increased risk that it will pose to these agents. We already know that the Trump camp in Mar-a-Lago released the documents last week that contained the identities of two agents that were on the scene. I'm sure there were many more than two agents on the search warrant, probably a dozen or more folks that were there. Those folks will now all be added to this group that's been targeted by the president's most extreme supporters and be subject to the same threats and threats of violence, and as will their families.
It's incredible that we're talking about a former president potentially endangering FBI agents. I mean, it's remarkable.
It was unthinkable and with any other former president, yeah. But that's where we are.
John, from a legal standpoint, is there any way that releasing this footage helps the former president? Or is it more from a public relations
standpoint?
Not
that I can think of. Well, I think it's a political effort on their behalf. I can't imagine that it would show the FBI planting or doing anything improper. They know the cameras are operating. So I think that it's really an effort by Trump to somehow use that material to try to make himself look like a victim. It's his constant theme of his grievances. So the other thing is, you've nailed it, the identification of the agents or the possible editing of the tape could distort the entire search. So there's just no good can come from releasing this.
And Caitlin, I mean, is that the reaction that some of the former president's advisors are hoping, that if they are arguing for the release of the footage, that it adds to sort of the indignity, the grievance list that the MAGA world has?
The argument that we've picked up on from sources, Anderson, is basically that they think it could energize people to see these agents actually inside the residence of a former president, which, of course, is very unusual. And that is something that even Attorney General Garland himself noted last week when he held that rare moment. They believe that it could help energize his base further than it already has. As you've seen, a lot of Republicans come out and criticize the FBI. Some of them, even the more extreme members, saying defund the FBI. They're arguing that this could show just how rare this is, that it is what Trump has claimed this is, which is a politically motivated search. Of course, we know it was a lawful search warrant that was signed off on by a judge. And you even saw Pence today arguing about that, saying, you know, you can criticize and question the attorney general, but don't criticize the rank and file law enforcement officers for just doing their jobs and carrying it out. And of course, that would be their identities that would be revealed potentially if this was released. But some of the people who are advocating for the release believe it would be good and it would help energize his base and basically give him another round of support that he has seen from Republicans to show these FBI agents actually inside his home.
What kind of protections does, I mean, an agent whose name is not redacted and is released out into the public, do they have?
Very little. FBI agents, unlike some other intelligence community agents, FBI agents don't operate under any sort of cover. They operate under true name in their communities. They're ready to go into court and take a stand and swear an oath and testify when that is required of them. So they are very exposed. I don't know that any of them ever anticipated they would be exposed in this way, and certainly not by a former president. But the idea that he would increase the risk that they face for some sort of political gain is, I'm sure, horrifying to those agents.
The New York Times reporting about the Justice Department getting a subpoena for earlier, before the raid, for some of the surveillance images, I guess, of the room where this material was, mm-hmm. and they're being concerned about something they saw. How do you interpret that?
Well, Anderson, I would expect that after the meeting in June, the agents were probably aware of the video surveillance. I'm told outside the room, so surveillance that would indicate who had access to that room. I would expect they reviewed that footage very closely to try to determine every person that had been into the room during the course of the surveillance they had access to. They may have been concerned about specific individuals they saw accessing that room and therefore having access to that material, or it may just have been a simple matter of volume. an overwhelming number of people going in and out all day is very different than a room that maybe had been described to them as, you know, locked under a special padlock and not accessed by anyone.
John, could this open the president or his allies up to any kind of legal liability if an attack happened on FBI agents or other federal law enforcement after release of their identities?
It's possible he's taking some jeopardy. I'm thinking he's more likely, while he's seeking a short-term gain, the long-term is going to be, I think, harsher on him. One, for doing it, particularly if anything does happen to any of the agents, if it is a clear distortion of what the raid was about and he tries to play that up, that will have a long-term negative impact. The base is not the majority. You got to remember, they're loud and they're an active minority, but they certainly don't control the entire narrative. So I think it's short-term thinking, where he thinks he can get a one day's headline that's positive for him, stir the base up a little bit, they'll like it, and he'll be happy with that. But then, as I say, in the long term, I think it's going to be harmful to him.
John Dean, Interim Cape, Caitlin Collins, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Coming up next, what we are learning about a plea deal from the man who was for decades the former president's top corporate money man, what Alan Weisselberg is expected to plead guilty to, and what he agreed to testify about in the future. And later, Congresswoman Liz Cheney's vow, after losing her primary last night, to do anything it takes to keep the former president from being elected again. What she said when asked if that includes running herself, and what her chances would be if she actually did, ahead on 360.
Thank you all. Thank you.
Big development now in another high-profile case we're following involving the former president. This one involves the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and Alan Weisselberg, the former longtime chief financial officer of the former president's namesake company. He is expected to plead guilty tomorrow to a 15-year tax fraud scheme. That's according to a source familiar with the matter. Now, the terms of the deal, they are still being finalized. Weisselberg may end up testifying against the company. That's despite the fact that he's not entered into a cooperation agreement with prosecutors. I'm joined now by CNN's Kara Scannell, who's been following it. What exactly is he pleading guilty to, and what does that mean that he's not entering into a cooperating agreement?
Right. So Alan Weisselberg was indicted last year along with the Trump Organization, and it was in a 15-count indictment going back 15 years that he was involved in this off-the-books compensation scheme, basically not paying taxes on some corporate benefits he got, like a company apartment, car leases.
So the Trump Organization would pay his car lease, would pay school tuition for his grandkids or things like that.
Exactly. And then he wasn't paying income tax on that. So he's going to admit to all of this tomorrow, according to sources. He will plead guilty to the entire indictment, and he's agreed to testify at trial. The Trump Organization, the corporate entity, no individual, is going to trial in October on these charges. Now, they have had testimony from other people. They've had an accountant who has worked with the Trump Organization, who has testified before the grand jury. But this will be a live witness. It will be Alan Weisselberg, the longtime CFO. He's been with the company for 40 years, going to testify against the company if it gets to trial.
Is it just testifying in this particular scheme against the company, or the company and other things they may have been involved with?
Well, that's the thing here. This is just for his testimony in the tax fraud trial. You know, remember, he got charged with this because prosecutors were trying to put pressure on him to cooperate in their much broader investigation into the Trump Organization's finance and whether they misled lenders and insurers. But Weisselberg was not willing to cooperate with that investigation. So he, you know, they was indicted a year ago, July. He's on the cusp of the trial in October. He just lost some motions to dismiss the indictment. He's now come to terms and said he's going to cooperate with this investigation. And for him, he gets some certainty here, because according to this deal, he would serve 5 months in prison with time off for good behavior. We're looking at 100 days. But these days would be served in Rikers Island, you know, the notorious New York City jail. But he gets the benefit of not having to go to trial, to potentially get convicted, to face, you know, anywhere from 1 to 3 years in prison to as much as 15 years in a New York State prison. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the calculus for him. He gets some certainty. He knows he will serve a limited prison term, and he will offer this cooperation.
And what's next for the criminal investigation in New York? Is that still ongoing?
Well, it's still ongoing, but as you probably remember, you know, the previous District Attorney Cy Vance had authorized his prosecutors to move forward with an indictment or to seek an indictment before the grand jury against the former president. The new District Attorney Alvin Bragg came in, reviewed the evidence, and said he didn't think there was enough there. Mm-hmm. One of the issues is they didn't have a cooperator. They didn't have someone like Weisselberg who was willing to tell the story behind the numbers. That investigation has slowed down. Sources tell me it's still ongoing. But there remains a lot of questions of what could they get that would satisfy the new DA that they have enough to bring an indictment when they didn't after already more than 3 years of investigating?
Eric Scannell, I appreciate it. Thanks. Joining me now to talk about it, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General and CNN legal analyst Elliot Williams. Why would they do a plea agreement with this guy if he wasn't going to cooperate in any criminal trial?
Now, believe it or not, Anderson, going to trial is really just a matter of resources and costs and benefits that prosecutors have to think through. And does it make more sense to go to trial and run the risk of losing and spend the resources of your time, your energy, your prosecutors, or guarantee that you get a conviction and someone going to jail? It sounds sort of odd to the
But it sounds like prosecutors kind of blinked. They decided, well, we'd rather get the conviction than
Nothing, or and lose, and maybe lose, because so much of what would have been on trial here is subjective. Now, some of it, there would be financial statements and records and so on. But this question, this is what Kara was talking about a little bit earlier. When we're talking about compensation or tuition being paid, there's a question of, well, maybe this might have actually been part of his compensation package. Right. And a jury could have been tricked by that or at least been confused enough by it to not get a conviction.
Rudy Giuliani testified before a grand jury in Georgia. The fact that he is a target has been informed he's a target of this investigation. How does that influence his testimony?
So here's the thing. Many people think they can just talk their way out of testimony. And maybe, and we know, we've seen Rudy Giuliani publicly, maybe he thought he might have been able to save himself by talking. If his lawyers were smart, they probably advised him to just keep his mouth shut because of the tremendous risk of jeopardizing his own rights if he does ultimately get charged with a crime.
So he could have just pled the fifth during this?
Yeah. And oddly enough, that can take 5 or 6 hours because every question other than, what's your name, Rudy Giuliani? Like, so for instance, how long have you served as Donald Trump's lawyer? I plead the fifth, because that could come up in a conspiracy trial. Hmm. Every possible fact. And so hour after hour, they were probably going through every question.
Can they just do a blanket, I plead the fifth?
I mean, they could, but prosecutors have a tremendous amount of information and they want to get him on the record, at least pleading the fifth. Hmm. But it seems odd, but it can take an entire day of doing that. And we saw that with the president quite recently.
There is a federal hearing tomorrow in Florida regarding the unsealing of the affidavit that was used to get the search warrant in Mar-a-Lago, which point out CNN and other news organizations have been pushing to try to get it actually released. The Justice Department obviously does not want it released. What's the likelihood that it would get released?
I would say highly, highly, highly unlikely that it ever gets released because of the fact that, number one, you want to protect the rights of innocent people who are named in it. Number two, you want to protect your evidence. Number three, you want to protect your agents and the work that they're doing. Usually courts defer to the Justice Department or prosecutors when they say, we will jeopardize our case or our investigation here if this becomes public.
And the Department of Justice had already said that. They've already said, look, this is going to deter any witnesses.
The judge would have to supersede that in effect and say, you know what, Justice Department, you don't know what's best for your own cases and the fact that there are innocent people here. You know what? There's enough public interest here. Let's make it public.
Could the judge rule that they would redact, any agents' names, any witness names?
Okay. If they redact this document, Anderson, it's basically going to be a search on whatever date, August 5th or whatever, black box for 5 pages, 20 pages.
Elliot Williams, appreciate it.
Thanks, Anderson.
Coming up, we're going to explore the future of Liz Cheney, who's teased a possible presidential campaign after a defeat last night in Wyoming. And later, we'll be joined by historian Doris Kearns Goodwin to discuss Cheney's fate and U.S. democracy's fate as well. As we reported before the votes came in last night, Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney was planning her political future, win or lose. The votes certainly came in, and she certainly lost badly to a candidate backed by the former president. As you might expect, he managed to get in his share of gloating. As for Congresswoman and Vice Chair of the January 6th Select Committee, she vowed to be part of a broad coalition to keep the former president away from the Oval Office. Now, when asked this morning whether that included actually running for president, here's what she told NBC's Savannah Guthrie.
You didn't say yes or no, and that's fine if you're thinking about it, but are you thinking about it? Are you thinking about running for president?
That's a decision that I'm going to make in the coming months, Savannah. I'm not going to make any announcements here this morning, but it is something that I'm thinking about, and I'll make a decision in the coming months.
So that said, the question is, who might support her? Also, would it even take votes away from the former president, which certainly would seem to be her objective? For Insight, we turn, as always, to CNN senior data reporter Harry Enten. So put Congresswoman Cheney's loss in perspective.
You know, the last time we were here in which a Trump, someone who voted to impeach Trump, lost in a historic way, I went back to the beginning of this century. Now I'm going to go back 60 years. I'm going to go back even further, dug deeper into the data sets. And what do we see? Liz Cheney lost by the second widest margin of any House incumbent in the last 60 years, losing by 37.4 points. This is just not anything I've basically ever heard of, except for one election in 2010. Mm. This is like nuts. I mean, that's really it. I don't know any way to say it. Then this is just not anything that I'm used to.
Especially considering how well she had done previously. She won with,
70+% of the vote. Incredible. She clearly did something very, very wrong in the voters' minds.
Yeah. So Cheney said she'll make a decision about 2024 in the coming months. Outside of Wyoming, how do Americans view her?
Yeah, I don't really understand this whole idea that she's going through. I guess she has to do something now. Look at her favorable rating nationally among all voters. You know, well south of 50%. You look among Republicans, where is it? It's 13%. Independents, well south of 50%. She does have a base, though. It's Democrats. That's where her favorable rating is above 50%. But the idea that you might be able to stop Donald Trump in a Republican primary when your favorable rating is just 13% doesn't make any sense to me.
But, I mean, of course, the question is, does she really think that, or does she just want to get on the debate stage and try to tear him down a little?
I mean, to me, if that is her idea, she is basically persona non grata among Republicans. If anything, I would bet if she took Trump on, it might actually make Trump more popular.
Why do you think she faces such an uphill battle? What are the numbers?
I mean, she's basically this unicorn, right? You know, think of how many people you know who
are a principled person.
A principled person may be a unicorn in our society these days. Think of people who are both pro-life and also believe that Biden legitimately won the election. What percentage do they total up of the population? Mm. They total just 13% of all voters.
What if she were to run as a third party or independent candidate?
Third party candidates just don't really work in this country. I mean, you'd have to go all the way back to Ross Perot, right? You just look at since the beginning of the century, you know, 2004, 2008, 2012, 2016, 2020. Look at the top third party candidates in all those years. Was it 1-3% at most? And remember back in 2016, Gary Johnson, there was this whole idea. Oh, Gary Johnson's going to do so well because Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are the two least liked national candidates of all time for major party nominees. And he got 3% of the vote. It just doesn't work. I don't understand this.
Well, so if her goal is to defeat the former president, running as an independent might take votes away.
It might take votes away from Biden. Right. That's what it could do. This equation just doesn't make sense to me when I run in my statistical software, Anderson.
All right. Well, we got to double check the software.
We're going to run Stata, R, and a little Python, maybe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You can put that in your wallet.
I can put it in my huge wallet right
here. This is Harry Enten's wallet. Look at this wallet. It's the biggest wallet, I mean, in the world.
You take a bite out of it. There's more cow here than in your burger.
Harry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joining us, CNN political commentator Alyssa Farah Griffin, who served as director of strategic communications in the previous administration. Also, David Urban, CNN political commentator, political consultant, and campaign strategist for the former president. So, Alyssa, what do you think Congresswoman Cheney's lane would look like in the short term and potentially in 2024?
Well, I don't disagree with any of Harry's analysis. I just want to be unequivocal about one thing. Liz Cheney lost for one reason and one reason only, that she denied the election myth, the lie that the election was stolen. She could have held that congressional seat comfortably for the rest of her life. She'd won in the 70s before. But what her lane is this, and I do think Harry's right about this, she's not, if she runs in 2024, she's not running to be president. Though she would be a decent general election candidate, she would be running to be a spoiler to Donald Trump, to juxtapose on a debate stage while he goes off spreading lies, spreading conspiracies, showing what a principled, conservative woman looks like and what our American values should be. I think it's powerful. I think she resonates with women. I think we'll see more polling in the coming months ahead about how she's actually a very formidable, inspiring figure. But again, she'd be running to be a spoiler, not because she thinks she's going to be the next president, at least right now.
David Urban, I mean, obviously 2024 is a long way off, but not that long way off. Do you think Liz Cheney would be an effective spoiler against the former president?
Anderson, I think today is Liz Cheney's high watermark. You know, when her father left office, he left with 17% favorability. So I noted from Harry's polls that she's slightly more favorable. Look, let's just face reality. When you're looking at the running in a presidential primary for, let's say, either on the Republican or Democratic ticket, there are major obstacles along the way to get to the end goal, right? So each state has really tough requirements getting on the ballot in each state, let alone getting on the debate stage, right? If you remember the last Republican primary, all the candidates had to sign a pledge saying that they would in fact support the eventual nominee at the end. I can never see Liz Cheney signing that pledge. If her goal is to defeat Donald Trump, she'll never make it to a debate stage with Donald Trump. Ronald McDaniel and the RNC will ensure that Liz Cheney is not even in the same state when there's a presidential debate taking place. So today's her high watermark.
David Urban's right about that. The RNC will definitely rig this coming election against anyone who wants to oppose sort of the direction it's heading in terms of promoting election fraud and election lies. So I don't actually disagree with that, but I would say this. She's got a few things in her favor that matter a ton. Money, name ID, and extraordinary favorability with women. I don't have the polls right in front of me, but I promise you in the coming months, you're going to see among women on either side of the aisle, they see her as somebody who stood athwart history, stood against the men, and did the right thing. And that's incredibly powerful.
I disagree. I don't see a lane forward for her. And even the most favorable of years, there's not a lane forward for Liz Cheney. She happens not to be a very good retail campaigner. She's more of a policy wonk than a people person. She doesn't like pressing the flesh. If you know anything about Iowa politics, Iowa caucuses in New Hampshire, it is intensive retail politics. You know, people in Iowa expect you to meet you 2, 3, 4, 5 times before they decide on you as a candidate. Liz Cheney's just not that person. There is zero path forward for Liz Cheney.
So, Alyssa, if it's not a presidential run or, you know, even a, not a, you know, wholehearted presidential run thinking she'd actually win, but just wanting to try to you know, stop the former president, what other lane would there be? I mean, there's really none unless she's running for something, right?
Well, listen, I think running for office is something she should consider purely for president, purely for that juxtaposition. But if not that, she's going to be a formidable voice for the country. And I will say this, you know this, Anderson, our politics are cyclical. There is going to be a time in the near future that Donald Trump is not the overwhelming force in our country. And I think our politics are going to course correct, where people are tired of conspiracy theories, they're tired of lies, and they're frankly tired of electing lunatics like people like the woman Harriet Hageman who beat her. And I think that's a moment when 56-year-old Liz Cheney, who was the person who did the right thing and said the right thing, could be a formidable force in the future. I don't think she's going anywhere. I find her personally deeply inspiring. I know many women do. And I think that that's a lane, and it's a power that she has behind her.
David, the Congresswoman Cheney was asked on the Today Show this morning about the ongoing battle in the Republican Party or for the soul of the Republican Party. I just want to play what she said.
I think the Republican Party today is in very bad shape. And I think that we have a tremendous amount of work to do. I think it could take several election cycles. But the country has got to have a Republican Party that's actually based on substance, based on principles, you know, based on a belief in limited government and low taxes and a strong national defense, a belief that the family has got to be the center of our community and of our lives. And those are the principles I believe in. That's what the party used to stand for. And we've got to get the party back to that.
David, do you think her vision for the party is realistic?
No, listen, Anderson, I'm not quite sure that it's not there currently, right? Unfortunately, you know, everybody sees the party through the lens of Donald Trump. I believe most Republicans still believe in those core values that Liz Cheney just articulated. I think that they just see Donald Trump as the best person for them battling for those values, right? That's what I see and I project as I, you know, talk to people across the United States, Pennsylvania, Florida, other places I travel. They see him as the best standard bearer for fighting for those values. Those values, they believe in all those values, Anderson. They just think that Trump is currently best suited to fight for them in these particular instances.
Alyssa, the final thought and then we're going to go.
Listen, when elected leaders lie to the general public and 60% of Americans think that the election was stolen, that's going to have an effect. Those are the values the Republican Party should be for, but it's not what they're electing. Harriet Hageman accused Joe Biden of being the biggest human trafficker in America. Is that really the kind of person Republicans want representing them? No, it's become cold. Like Liz Cheney was a better, more conservative representative.
Alyssa Farah Griffin, appreciate it. David Urban as well. Thanks so much. Coming up,
thanks, Anderson.
Pulitzer Prize winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me to talk about the future of Congresswoman Cheney, her party, and this country. During her speech last night, Congresswoman Cheney drew a comparison between her election loss and those of Abraham Lincoln before he became president. She set out to define the legacy she hopes to create for herself and the country.
The great and original champion of our party, Abraham Lincoln, was defeated in elections for the Senate and the House before he won the most important election of all. Lincoln ultimately prevailed. He saved our union. And he defined our obligation as Americans for all of history.
The Congresswoman then quoted a passage from one of Lincoln's and the country's most famous speeches, the Gettysburg Address. She spoke of the great task remaining, that the government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth. No person more qualified to talk about Lincoln and the historical importance of Cheney's words than Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. In addition to her acclaimed team of rivals, she's also the author of Leadership in Turbulent Times, about the moral purpose that guided four great American presidents, including Lincoln. Doris, it is great to have you back on the program. Thanks so much for being here. What does it say about where we are that a congresswoman standing up on principle for her beliefs and for truth and facts about the election not being stolen is overwhelmingly voted out of office?
Well, you know, I think she can take solace from Lincoln because, as she pointed out, he was defeated in 1858 in the Senate race. But what he said at the time, I think, is really important. He said, "Don't worry about me," to his supporters. "I'm not disheartened. I've made a hearing on the most durable issue of the day, and that will be remembered long after I'm gone." So there's a sense that where are the people right now that are willing to take, as you suggest, a principled stand, even if they're going to lose? And then the other great example that Lincoln can provide is in 1864, he was told in the summer of 1864 by the Republican bigwigs, "There's no way you're going to win that election in November. You're going to lose unless you're willing to compromise on slavery, not insist on the Emancipation Proclamation, just have the Union restored." And he said, "I would be damned in time and eternity if I turned my back on the black soldiers." He was willing to lose that election. But then what happens? Everything changes. The mood of the North changes when Atlanta falls. There are victories in the fall, and he's able to win that election with both the Union and emancipation. So who knows what the future is going to bring? We're just talking about 2024. There's the assumption that it'll be Trump there. Maybe it won't. But at least she's got renown. She's done something worthy. And I wish more of our politicians would think about their future and how it'll be remembered them than winning one stupid election again.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to Tim Alberta from The Atlantic last night, who wrote, quote, "This country is tracking toward a scale of political violence not seen since the Civil War. It's evident to anyone who spends significant time dwelling in the physical or virtual spaces of the American right." I know you've said previously that as a historian, you've resisted the idea that the U.S. could be heading toward a civil war. I'm wondering, do you still feel that way?
Well, you know, people keep asking me, are these the worst of times? And I keep trying to say, no, no, we've been through the Civil War, we've been through the Great Depression, we've been through the early days of World War II. But it prompted me in these recent weeks to just look back at a timetable of the 1850s. And it does prove pretty chilling. I mean, you have so many echoes, I think, of what we're seeing today. You had a partisan press. People only read the press of the paper that they liked, so they got different facts on different side. You had people who were not speaking the same language. The same event was interpreted in a different way. You had people from different sections who regarded themselves as the other rather than as common American citizens. And, you know, most importantly, when Lincoln was elected and after the Civil War started, what he said was that one of the central ideas they were fighting beyond the expansion of slavery was the idea that if you have a democracy and if you have one party, in that case, the Democratic Southern Party, willing to break up the Union simply because they lost an election and they won't accept that loss, then democracy will prove an absurdity and then ordinary people can't govern themselves. So that's where we are now. It's still incredible to me that people can say that the truth is on one side and we're fighting the truth. The truth is that election was not stolen. And if we fight about the fundamentals of that, then the trust in institutions is gone and the basis of democracy. But we still have the chance to fight that. The other chapters of our history still can be written, and that's what I got to keep believing. That's where the optimism comes from.
Well, it's so infuriating because we have more information now at our fingertips than they had in the 1850s. And you could understand why people just reading the newspapers that, you know, spoke to them would feel one way. But now there's no excuse for people going down these rabbit holes of fantasy and conspiracy. I spoke to you on January 8th of 2021, 2 days after the insurrection. You said that in 100 years from now, people will say that we suffered one of the worst crises we've ever been through, and you hope people that will be stunned that it even happened. Given what we've seen in the year and a half since then, do you still think that people looking back in 100 years will be stunned by what happened?
I surely hope so, but it gets more scary. I mean, when I talked to you that last time, I was certain that it would be regarded as an aberration. And there were hope in those early days after the attack on the Capitol. You had Mitch McConnell talk about the fact that President Trump was practically, he said, and morally responsible for what happened. Kevin McCarthy said that he was responsible for what happened. And then all of a sudden, things changed, and you have breaking news, and we're forgetting about January 6th. I've taken some sense of comfort in the January 6th hearings, which have proved, it seems to me, beyond unreasonable doubt, that there was responsibility, that the election was fair, and that there was a responsibility for what the president did in terms of actually stimulating the mob. And we were beginning to make, I think, breakthroughs. The Wall Street Journal editorial against it, and the New York Post, a Murdoch paper, saying silence is deafening. And now everything's turned around, of course, because of the search warrant. But I think that truth will out in the long run.
You just returned from Normandy, I understand. You stood on the Omaha and Utah beaches where Allied soldiers, incredible courage, charging into the fire against the German forces on D-Day. Those Allied soldiers are obviously making sacrifice for something bigger than themselves. What do you think, standing there, what lessons can be applied?
Oh, I'll tell you, Anderson, when I stood there and I just thought about those soldiers and what they were willing to sacrifice for honor, for duty, for freedom, for fighting against a fascist Nazi country, that was the greatest threat to Western civilization, I think, that's ever placed. And now that very democracy is at issue. And where are the people willing to sacrifice for that? We've got to hope that this next generation coming along will have those goals in mind, will have a sense of language and words that mean something. I mean, when I was there, where they were quoting Churchill, of course, and Churchill was able to arm the army with the power of words, you know, and Eisenhower giving the order of the day to those D-Day troopers saying, you're about to embark on a great crusade. Say the eyes of the world are upon you. And FDR talking about the fact that this generation is willing to sacrifice in order to protect democracy. We've just got to hope that somehow along the line, when you remember those moments in time, it'll give you a sense of pushing ahead to fight, that this is our fight that has to be fought. This is absolutely true. It's not an exaggeration that when an election is not accepted, peaceful transition of power is not accepted, that democracy is at issue. But it's our democracy. It's us, and we have to fight for it. And I feel more a need of fighting for it now than I did right after January 6th.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, bless you. I'm so happy to talk to you tonight. And you, yeah, it's, you give me hope. Thank you.
I hope so. Thank you.
All right. I wish you the best. Coming up, Western states facing mandatory water cuts due to the drought-stricken Colorado River. We'll have a live report from Bill Weir at Lake Mead next. Nevada and Arizona are cutting water usage from the shrinking Colorado River. Drought conditions have brought reservoirs along into record low levels. One is Lake Mead, about 25 miles from the Las Vegas Strip, and providing water to millions of people. Right now, it's only at 27% capacity. CNN's Bill Weir is there for us tonight. So just walk us through how low these water levels are.
It's so staggering, even if you haven't been out here in a couple of years, Anderson, to see just how far it's gone back. This was the water line in 2008. This is where that marina, that is way in the distance, was back then. It's a long walk to the top of the hill up there. It was where the drought started in the year 2000. And it has fallen down, as you said. It's a 27% capacity. Lake Powell, a little bit upstream, not much better off. And as a result, it's just been going down and down and down, triggering these agreed upon new cutbacks here. They got some monsoon rains recently. You might have seen the flooding at the Imperial Palace in Vegas. That was enough to raise the water levels here about 19 inches, but it's still 25 feet lower than it was this point last year. And we're getting dangerously close to Deadpool here, Anderson, in which it doesn't generate power. You can't send any water downstream. That would have huge economic implications. The mission in the near term is try to save the system in the next couple of years and talk about the infrastructure projects you're going to need to keep people alive in this new world.
And how are officials trying to cut water usage?
Well, there's some encouragement that you don't water in the middle of the day and maybe think about tearing up your lawn, but that doesn't go nearly far enough. Governor Newsom in California asked for, you know, voluntary cutbacks. They went nowhere near what they needed. That's why there's some frustration among water managers of the states. They were hoping that the Bureau of Reclamation, the feds, would come in and be sort of the tough parent and say, no, we're going to cut this by a couple million acre feet. You know, California is entitled to over 4 million acre feet a year. They are asking the states to voluntarily come up with a fair way to cut that much out of the system, and they couldn't agree at all. Now they're frustrated. Nobody knows what to do. In the meantime, the water is evaporating, and the lakes just get lower and lower.
They've also discovered human remains. What's the latest on that?
Yeah, this week it was the fifth report of human remains right on the swim beach, right in this area here. They're not sure if these were bones from another body that they had been found earlier, but this is another gruesome discovery here. They found a body in a barrel with a bullet wound in the head that they believe was a mob hit from the late 70s, early 80s as well. They found boats from World War II era that sank here as well. It's just, you know, this was all desert until we decided to build Hoover Dam and try to control the flow of all that snowpack melting. And it's created 40 million, you know, society for 40 million people from Albuquerque and Denver to San Diego. But the old way of thinking that this is a land of abundance and then you can use as much water as you want forever, those days are sadly over. And actually, probably the emergency level is a lot higher than people even realize yet.
Yeah, it's stunning to see how far down it is. But we appreciate it. Thank you very much. We'll be right back. The news continues. Let's hand it over to Allison Camerota and CNN Tonight. Allison.
Now streaming exclusively on Max. A new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.